Welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about Murder Must Advertise by Dorothy Sayers. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Gina D'Alfonso, whose books include Dorothy and Jack, The Transforming Friendship of Dorothy L. Sayers and C.S. Lewis, as well as The Gospel in Dickens. She's the impresario of the website Dickens Blog. Her Substack newsletter is Dear Strange Things, and she podcasted with us previously on A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. That was show number 159 in this podcast series. She joins us by phone as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Gina, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Why is Murder Must Advertise by Dorothy Sayers a great book?
Dorothy L. Sayers in this book creates a whole world. Actually, it would be more accurate to say she creates three worlds that her detective, Lord Peter, is living in all at the same time. And it's really a tour de force. She brings this whole world of an advertising agency to life where he is going undercover to try to solve a murder. And she had worked at an advertising agency, so she knew that scene very, very well. And she creates this great workplace comedy with all these vivid characters, even though there are dramatic and sometimes tragic aspects to it, ultimately, it's just this wonderful, on many levels, it's just this wonderful workplace comedy. Then just underneath that, when you scratch the surface a little bit, there's some sort of mysterious connection going on with a drug ring, and so there's this whole criminal underworld in which Lord Peter Wimsey goes under further cover, dressing up as a harlequin to find information that he's looking for. And so it's almost this blend of realism and fantasy, not supernatural fantasy, I don't mean, but she creates this sort of fantasy criminal underworld with all sorts of fantastical and strange and dreamlike aspects to it. So you have these two worlds, and then in between, Lord Peter Wimsey is just sort of hanging out with his sister and brother-in-law, who happens to be a detective also, in this cozy little domestic scene. So she's just shifting back and forth among all these worlds. She refers to her worlds as dream cities. There's the dream city, the nighttime fantasy world of the criminal enterprise. But then also she talks about how the world of the advertising agency is a dream city in a way, because the jobs of all these people at the ad agency is to sort of create this utopia wonderland where they can lure people to buy things and more things and more things. So they're sort of creating a dream city of their own. And this was a theme that really interested Sayers, having worked in advertising. Because she's dealing with a mystery novel, and that was her genre, she got to explore moral themes that she wanted to explore in a way that wasn't heavy-handed or preachy. She got to say, okay, what is advertising really? What does it do? Is it bad for the economy? Does it create envy, resentment, greed, all these bad things? So basically you have all this going on in one very lively and funny and interesting novel, and it really is a great achievement. It's fun to read.
We're going to talk about all that, the different worlds it investigates, particularly the ad agency and the main character at the center of the story, the murder mystery that holds the plot together, the remarkable woman behind this book. But Gina, let's start with chapter one of Murder Must Advertise, published in 1933. Chapter one is called Death Comes to Pym's Publicity, and it describes the arrival of a junior copywriter called Death Breeden, which is an odd name, who is taking over the work of Victor Dean, a junior copywriter who was found dead at the bottom of a spiral staircase at the Pym's office in London. What's going on here?
Well, first of all, that name, Death Breeden, as you said, is very odd. Anyone who knows the series already will know that Peter Death Breeden Wimsey is Lord Peter's full name, and so he uses just his middle names as his alias, which may seem a little bit risky, but he does it anyway. And just to go around calling yourself Death is something that, I mean, it's kind of audacious. And Sayers, who loved wordplay and loved making up fancy backstories for her characters, somewhere or other, not in this book, but somewhere, she indulged her talent for wordplay and came up with a story that the name was originally D apostrophe S or something like that. It came from Old French or something like that. But really, she's just doing this because she wants to give her character the name Death, which is kind of fun for her. So, but anyway, he comes to this ad agency calling himself that because he's gotten word that something fishy happened here. Not all was as it seemed regarding this man's death. He had fallen down a staircase, broken his neck, and cracked his skull, and all kinds of horrible things. But there was more to it than just that. So he is going to be, Lord Peter is going to be a copywriter. And Sayers has a lot of fun with this, too. Fun, maybe not quite the right word, because when she first created Lord Peter, she admitted she made him incredibly rich so that she could live vicariously through him, because she was not at all rich at the time. But now she's got this rich character, and she's like, okay, what happens if we put this rich character into a world where there's all these working people, and some of them are pretty hard up? And how does he interact with them? What does he learn about them? How does he get maybe shaken out of his complacency a little bit? So Sayers was really brilliant at taking things she had put into the series earlier just for any old reason and then saying, okay, here we have this interesting aspect of this character. Now, how can I build on this and make it more interesting and make it more three-dimensional? So that's what you can see her doing here.
I want to ask about Peter Wimsey in a moment, but first a quick question. You've mentioned this is a series of books. He's a series character, and people who come to this book with some foreknowledge from having read mm-hmm. other books in the series, that they may be a little bit ahead of people who come to this one first. But you can read this one first. You can read it out of order and enjoy mm-hmm. it, right? This is the eighth in the series that features Lord mm-hmm. Peter Wimsey. And we did a show, not you and I, but this podcast did a show on the 10th in the series called Gaudy Night. That's show number 127. But can you just open this book? Can this be your first Dorothy Sayers novel? And can you enjoy it?
Yes, I think it absolutely works as a standalone. A lot of her books do. The first one I read of hers was Gaudy Night, and as you say, that comes later in the series, and I was able to pick up things pretty easily. You know, there are references to Peter's family members and to occasionally to some things that came before, but it's very easy to pick up on. And my one slight quarrel with this novel is that Harriet Vane is not in it, Harriet being the love interest for Lord Peter, who comes along in the book called Strong Poison. And once Harriet was introduced, Sayers sort of went back and forth between novels with her and novels without her. And here she gets only one sentence. We see Lord Peter go off to keep a date with her, but we don't get to find out what happened on that date. So at this point, she is in existence, but we don't really get to see her. And I miss her because she's a character that I really like. To go back to your question, yes, I think this one absolutely works as a standalone. You can jump in and pick things up.
Now, tell us more about Lord Peter Wimsey. He's an amateur aristocrat detective. He's a little bit Sherlock Holmes, a little bit Father Brown. Tell us more about him. Who is he?
He's a little bit of all those things. He is introduced in the book Whose Body, which I think was published in 1923. He comes across just at first as very frivolous, almost a little bit like a P.G. Woodhouse character in a way, like Bertie Wooster or somebody like that. But we quickly learn that he's very brilliant. He does detecting for a hobby because he needed a hobby after World War I when he came out with shell shock and was kind of at a loose end and needed something to concentrate on to bring him out of it. So he picked up this hobby of detecting. He turned out to be wonderful at it. And as we go along through the series, she fleshes him out as a character. I mean, he always has that sort of fun and whimsical, no pun intended, aspect to him. He loves to joke around, to talk piffle, as Harriet calls it. He loves to play literary games and throw Shakespeare and Dickens and all kinds of quotes out there. He likes to have fun, but he also has his very serious side, and that sort of comes out in his detective work.
So he shows up in Murder Must Advertise at the ad agency. He's calling himself Death Breeden. He's got this weird alias. He investigates the death of Victor Dean. Was this an accident or was it murder? What does he learn as he enters the ad agency?
He learns a lot. He learns that he's very intelligent and he's able to learn fast, but he finds out that he's in a world that's not quite like any he's ever known. He knows the world of the wealthy very intimately, of course. He's part of it. He knows the world of the lower classes because he's often gone into that world in the course of his detection. But actually being a member of the workplace, you know, day after day, going to work and having to get a job done is new to him. And he's actually doing a job. He's working as a copywriter because that's what he went undercover as. And so he's learning all these things, and he's learning things about the workplace, too, that are germane to the mystery. For instance, nobody's ever where they're supposed to be. Nobody ever stays in their office for 5 minutes altogether. Everybody's always popping out to hang out in the typist's room or to go up on the roof for something or other, going into conference rooms or being called into other people's offices. So he finds out how difficult it is to solve a murder mystery when you can't ever figure out, okay, who was where at what time, because everybody is everywhere all the time. He's learning all kinds of things he never knew before, and he's also learning how they relate to the mystery of how and why this man fell down a staircase.
And this is one of the comic elements of the tale, this idea of you can't find anybody when you want to. But tell us a little bit about what ad agencies were like at this time. You said Dorothy Sayers worked at one in the 1920s. This book is a 1933 book. It feels so modern in some ways,
yes,
because
yes,
this is our world, a world of commerce and advertising that may have felt very new to them. It feels familiar to us in a lot of ways. But what was an ad agency like back then?
First of all, it's amazing the amount of work they managed to get done with everybody sort of popping all over the place all the time. So in some ways, it's your basic workplace with all kinds of different relationships going on, people forming friendships, people making enemies, people fighting, and then people having to put their quarrels aside and get the job done. So it's all sorts of all those dynamics playing out in very interesting ways. As far as the actual work, Sayers did very well in advertising. She came up with the Guinness is Good for You slogan that was really famous. She created a whole campaign called the Mustard Club that was really big, and she even name checks it in this book because Lord Peter comes up with something similar called a Whifflets campaign, and he says it'll be the biggest thing since the Mustard Club. So that's Sayers sort of patting herself on the back a little bit. But for all her qualms about advertising as a profession, is it really good for the economy or is it puffing it up in ways that aren't healthy? She did like that it gave her the opportunity to exercise her creativity, that she got to indulge in wordplay. You know, we see Lord Peter coming up with a whole campaign based on literary quotes, which he loves, and he has just so much fun with it, and it's really easy for him. So he gets to exercise that side of his brain. If we can go by this book, I mean, I think Sayers probably felt a lot of camaraderie when she was working at an ad agency. She sort of draws this with a loving eye for detail and for all the different interactions and bickering and bantering that goes on. So you can see she kind of enjoyed that. And at the same time, she gives you a little hint of what it was like to be a woman in the workplace then and how sometimes your position could be a little bit precarious. Like you see at least two women complaining about how the men would see them like at the races with a gentleman friend and then tell on them. Like, you know, you can't even go to the races with a gentleman friend without worrying about your position. And Sayers experienced a taste of that herself when she was working. You know, she, I guess we can go into this briefly. she actually ended up dealing with an illegitimate pregnancy at this point in her life, and she had to hide it extremely carefully or she would have been out of a job, and she was desperate not to be out of a job because now she's going to have a baby and she'll have to support him financially. So she hid this pregnancy so carefully that no one she worked with ever knew. So when she throws these little things into Murder Must Advertise, I mean, they don't look like anything much in passing, but it's kind of a hint at something much bigger that she had to deal with as a woman who had run into trouble. So she's giving you just a little tiny hint of what that was like.
This experience gives the setting of Murder Must Advertise a great deal of authenticity. You really mm-hmm. do feel like you are there, and she knew what she was talking about. She also had some misgivings about the ethics of advertising. For as much mm-hmm. fun as she found it to be, and the wordplay and the cleverness it required, she also had some misgivings. And at one point in the book, ads are described as their essence is, quote, to tell plausible lies for money, unquote.
Right.
This
mm-hmm.
bothered her a little bit, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It was very typical of her that she would put her own experiences and her own characteristics and any part of herself that she felt uneasy about it, she would put it into fiction. She was not the sort of person to create a heroic self-insert. She was more likely to take anything that she didn't like about herself and put it into her work. And in this case, she's putting in a whole field where she had worked, she had done well, she had liked it, but also she's feeling uneasy about what it does to the economy and the nature of the work itself. You quoted that part about telling plausible lies for money. That's part of it. You have to sort of exaggerate and build up a product. There's another line where Lord Peter and some of his colleagues there are talking about how, you know, we strip the vitamins out of one product, or their clients do, rather. They strip the vitamins out of one product and they put it into another product and then they try to sell you both products. And so she's got all these qualms about all the things they do. She sees all that going on and she's trying to ask, is it really okay to do this? And then she's also thinking about how people, and relatively poor people, working class people, are being urged to spend more than they have on things that they really don't need, on products that sometimes are shoddy, and she's sort of exploring this and saying, you know, is this really right? Is this really healthy? Is this not just propping up the economy in a way that's ultimately bad for it and bad for people? And as I said before, because she's working in this particular genre, she can go into these themes and not be moralistic or heavy-handed about it. And at one point, she even compares advertising, the dream city of advertising, to the dream city of the night where the drug trade is going on. She has Peter and Charles Parker, his brother-in-law, talking about how, well, maybe there are some similarities between advertising and the drug trade. So she even goes as far as to say that. So she's not just introducing the drug trade as, you know, a reason for the murder. She's picking up parallels and showing them. And so it's her willing to question herself, the field that she spent so much time in, and a field that is that is seen as very important to the economy and to the country.
Let's dive in now to this underworld of the drug trade. Of course, a lot of the appeal of this book comes from the bit about the advertising and the social commentary that comes along with that, and the bits of this that feel like a novel of manners almost in the mm-hmm. workplace and so on. But it really is a detective novel, and mm-hmm. and we're investigating the death of Victor Dean. As Peter Wimsey does this, what does he learn? What does he see?
He sees that Victor Dean was up to much more than anybody knew about it. And yet, I don't want to get too spoilery because I'm not used to talking about mysteries on podcasts, and so I have to be very careful what I say and not give too much away. So So Victor Dean was involved in something that he himself didn't even really know the extent of. But he knew enough to become dangerous, and it became in somebody's interest to get rid of him. So the more Lord Peter gets into this, the more he has to dig into the drug trade. He gets acquainted with these very dubious and shady characters, and his own attitude is, Lord Peter's own attitude is interesting. You know, he's solved a lot of crimes. He's been a lot of places. He's seen a lot of things. He's not really easy to shock, but the people involved in this cocaine ring are a little bit shocking even to him. Strikes up a friendship with this woman, Diane, who is, friendship is not quite the word. She's sort of attracted to him and sort of afraid of him and sort of interested in him, and he hangs around her sort of pumping her for all the information he can get, but she doesn't really know a lot, but she knows people who know a lot. So there's all these like mysterious and shadowy connections going on, but the ultimate aim is to figure out who's running this drug trade, how it's run, how they can figure out how it's run so they can catch the people on top. And part of that, so solving the murder is really part of that. What they really, really want to do is catch the bigwigs and put an end to this particular drug ring, but that and the murder are all tied up together. So it's a big project that Lord Peter has taken on, and it's no wonder he has to work both day and night to try to figure this out.
Murder and cocaine and high society. It almost sounds like an episode of Miami Vice from the 1980s. You mentioned that it has a blend of realism and fantasy, not supernatural fantasy, but the fantastic. And there's an episode that involves a harlequin and a costume party. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that scene. Why is it important?
It sort of exemplifies what I'm talking about, where it feels like fantasy even though it really isn't. I mean, Sayers could be a very realistic novelist, but she liked to let this side of herself go every once in a while. She likes to come up with these truly fantastic scenarios. So we see Lord Peter dressed up as a harlequin at this party, diving off the top of a really high fountain into a pool below. And this is how he catches Diane's attention in the first place, because she likes people who do dangerous stunts and things like that. So that's how he first catches her attention. That's how he sort of gets into her inner circle. That's how she takes up with him in the first place. It's a difficult thing for a novelist like Sayers to pull off, because, as I said, most of the time she's pretty realistic, she's pretty grounded. I mean, even though she's dealing with a rich detective and sort of like not exactly grounded in the middle class working world, but she's, what I'm trying to say is, she's more of a realistic novelist generally, and she doesn't always go into fantastic scenarios, but when she does, she goes big, you know, go big or go home. And so it's really hard to imagine this sort of thing happening for real, like a harlequin diving off a fountain at a party, but she makes it happen and she makes it work.
Dorothy Sayers had a lot of success, a lot of commercial success, also critical success as an author of mystery novels. You're the author of a book called Dorothy and Jack, The Transforming Friendship of Dorothy L. Sayers and C.S. Lewis. Was C.S. Lewis a fan of her murder mysteries, and how did those two connect?
Interestingly, he was not really a fan of her murder mysteries, because he wasn't a fan of murder mysteries in general. They actually connected when she was an established writer, and she was, in addition to murder mysteries, she was writing essays and Christian apologetics and things like that. He was an up-and-coming writer, and she wrote him a fan letter, and that's how they got together. They established this delightful correspondence. They became very good friends. And interestingly, towards the end of their lives, I think he started to soften a little bit towards her mysteries because he got married to Joy Davidman, and Joy Davidman was a big fan of Sayers' mysteries, and C.S. Lewis's brother was also a fan of the mysteries. And so I think sheerly through hearing his wife and brother talk about them and praise them, I think Lewis started to soften towards her mysteries a little bit.
They're hard not to like. And she also translated Dante's Divine Comedy, which is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many, you know, murder mystery authors today would go on to do that. And she's remembered now in a lot of ways, not just for these Lord Peter Wimsey novels, which are so much fun to read, but as a kind of champion of the traditional liberal arts and an inspirational figure in that sense.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, she was a brilliant woman. She, as you've been saying, she could basically do it all. She was an advocate for what we know as classical education. Not that she spent a lot of time in that field, but she was interested in it. She wrote about it and talked about it. As you say, she was a translator of Dante and a passionate fan of his. I mean, she spent the latter part of her life translating Dante, researching him, writing about him, speaking about him, you know, just trying to get people to read him. Her big thing was, you know, you think of him as this dull, stuffy old author, but he's anything but. He's a wonderful, lively, funny author, and you should read him. And she got a lot of people reading him. Her enthusiasm was contagious. And so she really enjoyed spending the latter part of her life doing that. And Lewis was a friend and champion in that aspect as well. He enjoyed her translations. He encouraged her. She said his praise really meant a lot to her because he got what she was trying to do with her translation. He understood. She could talk shop with him, and she really enjoyed that.
I suspect a lot of people are like C.S. Lewis, at least C.S. Lewis initially, in the sense that they may be admirers of Dante, and they think a murder mystery is trivial, that it's not very important, and that there are much greater forms of literature. But Sayers was a real defender of that genre. She not only wrote in it, but she was an editor of collections. She was a kind of apologist for the detective novel, the murder mystery, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Why did she take it so seriously?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, she found it a great way to explore moral themes. She even has Lord Peter say somewhere that they're the purest literature we have because right is rewarded and evil is found out and punished. That's not to say she was a totally black and white thinker, because she was interested in diving into some of these moral themes and all their complexity, and realizing that, you know, all of us are sinners and it's part of all our nature and so forth. But she did find it a great opportunity to explore these themes, and also she just found them great fun and wonderful intellectual puzzles when done well. You mentioned that she was a booster of the form in general, and along those lines, I'd like to recommend a book that she edited called Taking Detective Stories Seriously. Actually, it's not correct to say she edited it. It's actually a book of her mystery reviews that she wrote. So it's a collection of pieces that ran as articles originally. It's wonderful reading. I mean, she knew this genre so well. She understood its possibilities. She just did great things with it.
One more question as we wrap up. There are so many great crime novelists at work today. What's the case for reading Murder Must Advertise now? It's almost 100 years old. Is it still fresh? Is there a reason to open up this book today?
I think it absolutely feels fresh. Pick it up and it will just suck you right in. I mean, you're pulled right into this workplace where there's all this intrigue going on, and at the same time there's all this comedy going on, these wonderful characters. It's just lively and interesting and will keep you turning pages. One thing I haven't had a chance to mention yet is Harriet Vane is often, I mentioned her before, she's often considered to be very much like Sayers herself, and she is, but you have a character in this book called Miss Medillard, another copywriter, who is, I think, possibly even more of Sayers. She's she's a university-educated copywriter, like Sarah's was. She's funny and caustic, cynical. She indulges in a naughty limerick from time to time, which Sarah's was known to do. And so she's just a fascinating person for finding out more about this world, for finding out more about Sayers in particular. But the whole book is like that. It's full of interesting people and situations. It makes you laugh, and it makes you think, and it makes you ask questions, and does everything a good book should do, really.
Gina DelFonso, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about Murder Must Advertise by Dorothy Sayers.
Thank you.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Before you go, here's a special message from National Review Institute. Dust off your tuxedo or ball gown. Join National Review Institute on October 21st at the Fairmont in Dallas, Texas for the 8th annual William F. Buckley Jr. Prize Dinner. This year's gala will honor Leonard Leo and Eugene Meyer of the Federalist Society with the Buckley Prize for Leadership and Political Thought, and Adam Meyerson, former president of the Philanthropy Roundtable, with the Buckley Prize for Leadership in Supporting Liberty. We'll hope you join NRI for the special Black Tie Affair, celebrating Bill Buckley's legacy, the National Review mission, and our esteemed honorees. Limited tickets and sponsorships are available. All proceeds go to support NRI's educational and outreach programs that advance the principles of a free society. RSVP online at www.nrinstitute.org. That's www.nrinstitute.org. We hope to see you in the Lone Star State this October. Before you go, don't forget to subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is at haymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.